Hello everyone, welcome to the second season of the series of podcasts with IEEE Electron Devices Society Luminaries. As the world's largest professional organization, IEEE plays a significant role to enhance the quality of our life. Electron Devices Society, or EDS, encompasses activities involving electron devices, the main enabler for today's digital world. I'm Muhammad Mustafa Hussain, a professor of Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering of Purdue University. I play a variety of roles in different capacities within the Electron Devices Society of IEEE. In this series of podcasts, we will be interviewing those EDS members who have made remarkable impacts in our society through their innovations and dedication. Our guest is someone whose seminal contributions to the field of reliability engineering in semiconductor devices has made significant impact. We are speaking with Professor Muhammad Ashraful Alam of Purdue University. Muhammad Ashraful Alam has made fundamental contributions to the physics and technology of a remarkable range of classical and emerging electronic devices, including the reliability of nanoscale logic and power transistors, sensitivity limits of biosensors, percolative transport in flexible electronics, atom to form modeling of solar cells. He's known for his ability to connect deep fundamental science to important practical problems. His research approach is informed by the simple belief that problem has to be timely, but the solution timeless. Muhammad Alam was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh in 1964. He received a bachelor's in electrical engineering degree from Bangladesh University of Engineering and Technology in 1988 and master's degree from Clarkson University, Potsdam, New York in 1991. And a PhD degree from Purdue University, Lafayette, Indiana, in 1995, all in electrical engineering. Dr. Alam joined AT&T Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, in 1995 as a member of technical staff in the computational device modeling group. Initially, his research focused on the direct modulation limits of semiconductor lasers. Later, he developed mathematical models of MOCVD crystal growth for applications in WDM optoelectronic integrated circuits. In 1998, Dr. Alam moved to Silicon ULSI research department within Bell Labs to work on the reliability limits for ultra-thin gate dielectrics and the implications of soft broken oxides. For these contributions, he was named Distinguished Member of Technical Staff in 2001, when the semiconductor division of Bell Labs joined Aguirre Systems, Alam became the technical manager of the Aguirre IC Reliability Group. Since 2004, he has been with the ECE department at Purdue University, working on IC reliability nanocomposite-based flexible electronics and nanobiosensors. As the Jai N. Gupta Endowed Chair Professor at Purdue University, Professor Alam provides a stellar example of how education and research complement each other. His teaching emphasizes crystal clear thinking of multilayer, multiphysics, technologically important concepts. He uses a deep appreciation of the historical context and has a gift of using simple analogies to bring a topic alive for a broad audience. More than 400,000 students worldwide have learned some aspects of semiconductor devices from his web-enabled courses. Professor Alam is a fellow of the IEEE, the American Physical Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His awards include IEEE Tomiyasu Award for his fundamental contributions to device technology for communication systems, 2015 SRC Technical Excellence Award, and the 2018 IEEE Electron Devices Society Education Award for educating, inspiring, and mentoring students and electron device professionals around the world. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. And thanks for this opportunity. I've heard the other podcast in the series, and it was really a pleasure to listen to various experiences. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. You are deserving here. So today we are going to hear your story, and through this podcast, this episode, the audience, they will get to know you better. So I'll go back and we'll start from the very beginning, which is about your childhood. So how was it, and if there is any regret that you had. So please go ahead.
Yeah, I was born in Bangladesh. For the first few years, of course, when you're younger, things are very good. But I grew up, most of my childhood was immediately following the War of Independence in 1971, when Bangladesh became independent. And during that time, when you are fleeing through a river, when an army is invading the city, and you see sort of dead bodies float by, it makes an impression on you. And what I realized that since then is that you take nothing for granted. You're grateful for things that you have and don't worry so much about things that you don't, because at the end, things have a way of sort of working out. So for example, in our high school and colleges, there were many resource constraints when they are going up. Although it was an engineering school, it probably lacked faculty in variety of topics that I was really interested in. But what I realized that instead of focusing on the things that we don't have, there were excellent teachers, for example, in electromagnetics and thermodynamics and fluid mechanics. So I focused on learning what was offered to the best of my ability. And I think, so in that sense, things worked out very well downstream. I don't really have any regrets, none. I think like any snowflake, the journey that you make makes you the scientist you are at the end of the day. And if I had taken a different path, I'd be a different scientist. So therefore, I don't have any regrets about things I didn't have. I had quite a few things that for which I'm grateful.
Great. That you brought up, I get very connected because I was also born in Bangladesh, but 5 years after our liberation war. So thanks for sharing those stories. Those are not always told, but again, that within the hardship, not to look at only the when the glass is half empty, but also to look at the when the glass is full, half full. And in a sense, maybe a balanced approach is actually to recognize that the glass can actually be full also going forward.
That's right.
Okay. So after that, when you came to the USA for your graduate study, and so how was your graduate student life?
So this was sort of, it is a transformative experience. I came from Bangladesh first to Clarkson University to work with a terrific professor, Professor Abul Khandakar. He was getting started in quantum transport in material. I didn't know anything about quantum transport. But it was in an electrical engineering department. The electrical engineering department at Clarkson University, upstate New York, was good. but the world-class research was happening in the physics and chemistry and the math department. Every afternoon, you could walk up into any of those open seminar rooms, and there would be professor discussing. And what was really impressive for me, that the breadth of these professors had and the types of work, for example, in colloids, the statistical mechanics, non-equilibrium systems, non-linear mathematical, non-linear differential equations. And even though I was a student, somehow they welcomed us with open arms. In some way, you could just walk in and listen. Professors would be debating among themselves, a small school. So that was sort of a really eye-opening experience, that science need not be this, you know, a big professor sitting or standing on a pedestal, and then you are sort of learning at the footsteps, but rather an enjoyable collaborative process where you're trying to find out, unravel the mysteries of different types of things. So I really enjoyed that, and I had an excellent background in physics and mathematics from Clarkson University. When I came to Purdue University to work with Professor Mark Lundstrom, another person you have interviewed for the series, I, of course, learned many things from Professor Lundstrom in terms of transport equations, ultra-small devices. When the transistors become very small, these days, you know, 10 nanometer, 7 nanometer channel lengths, how electrons get ballistic over the channels and so on. So we learned all this. But more important, I learned something, that a excellence and humility, these need not be mutually exclusive, that these can come in the same package, and you can do extraordinary work, but also be extra unfailingly kind to the people around you. I think this is something I took away from my graduate school. Very good technical training I had, I'm fortunate, but also a set of access to set of excellent people who are good human beings to begin with.
I think that's kind of a repetitious process that, like, you know, the every advisor, they are basically reflected through their mentees in the sense. And every time, Professor Lundstrom, when someone comes across him, they will know the depth of the person that he carries, his character, you know, the personality, but at the same time, like, you know, the knowledge base that he also adds to that, everyone respects. And I think, like, you know, that is not always, like, you know, the so normal. I think, like, you know, that's quite, at some point, it seems like surreal, not exactly real.
I think the opportunity for the people who are sort of kind is that they have an ability to listen. And this is what I have also tried to learn, that only when you are in a seminar, you listen 100% by removing any preconceived ideas, and even it may be a favorite idea, but being able to listen deeply requires one to essentially be humble in a way so that it allows a deep communication. Because without listening, I think it is very difficult to make fundamental contributions to any field, let alone engineering.
Correct. So when you were in Purdue, for your PhD, and then if I'm not that wrong, then you joined Bell Labs.
Right.
That was your first employment. So how was your experience there?
So, you know, Bell Labs is a legendary organization, and it is in Murray Hill, New Jersey. Bell Labs have many branches, of course. There are about 14 in different places, but this lab that is storied lab is at Murray Hill, where transistors were invented. communication theory, Shannon's work, and all those things were done. So the first day I walked in, I was terrified that people will soon figure out that I really didn't know much, and then they will throw me out of this place. Because once you go in the entryway, there are these notebooks of Shannon and Anderson, both of whom are, of course, towering personality. There are all this replica of transistors, cascade lasers, all sorts of things are there, the Vanguard small replica of the satellite. And then when I was walking through the corridor, then the first time I saw Horst Stromer, who would win Nobel Prize for fractional quantum Hall effect after, I think, about 2 years or so. So this was sort of a very interesting experience. But I soon realized that these people are exceptional, not because they necessarily knew everything, but they had a very interesting way of asking questions. And they are more interested in connecting the dots and getting unconventional answers to conventional questions. And I realized that they are good because they are a little fearless in what they how they approach problems. So this was a wonderfully supportive environment. I got a lot of support from them. I really liked it.
Well, you know, that one of the things that many people say that asking the right questions is the first step to get the right answers. And, you know, the most probably the best trait of a really good researcher is to see things what others are not seeing right away, right? Right. So the different perspectives, those come out from these answers are because of that, the different way of looking at things, not from the just like, you know, the same way. But
right. So one quick thing about Bell Labs, one thing that is exceptional is that they had a lunch place which could hold close to probably 1,000 people. And the rooms were old, uncomfortable. The doors were sort of didn't always lock properly. But the offices were not very comfortable. You know, it's an old building in some way. But everybody looked forward to the lunch table. And the lunch table was where all the most interesting discussion happened. And people, of course, start talking by stock market and this and that for first 5 minutes. But these are deeply deep scientists. So very soon the discussion moves into open problems in science, what has been done recently elsewhere, who has gone to a particular conference and what they have learned. So I think this informal ecosystem of crisscrossing ideas is where most of the beautiful ideas emerge. I think in university, sometimes I have missed that because when the rooms are comfortable and you are working with your own group, this opportunity to discuss things in an informal setting is sometimes lost.
Well, I think, like, you know, some of my colleagues in the applied math, they actually suggest that their conferences are like this, that they get together in a very beautiful place. It's okay. But then they start conversation, right? Like, you know, it is the way that it's like musical chair. They go through this conversation with different folks. And that's the way that they always say that our networking, that provides us with the opportunity to expand. And that's the way that they expand. But maybe in engineering, like, you know, it is kind of a halted process at the moment. But and today's most of the Bay Area's or Silicon Valley's office spaces, when they are just like, you know, the open space and people are sitting comfortably, whatever the way that is convenient for them, and when they're talking, we can see that what's happening right now, right? Like, you know, all these new ideas and new technologies are emerging from there. So my follow-up question is going to be, in Bell Labs even, there were so many different things to right, like on the to talk or to choose. And when you started, you were focused on the deep level physics. I would say that the physical phenomena of different things. But eventually, you know, that you found your home with electron devices. That's great for us. But the question is that what really inspired you to choose electron devices eventually to settle in?
So you are right that my initial interest were in physics, deep physics of, in particular, answering this question that what is the maximum frequency of oscillation in semiconductor lasers? And this was also a very practical question because depending on what the maximum frequency of oscillation is, a optical fiber would be able to carry a certain number of TV channels or a certain amount of information. And so this was a very important question that what is the nonlinearity, if there is any mode coupling and these type of questions. And I tried to answer them, as you said, from a foundational perspective. Actually, one single thing changed everything for me. So one day I had finished my presentation in one of the group thing and everybody was sort of happy. You know, these are kind people. So they were happy. Then another group of people entered that room. It was a meeting room. And before I had a chance to escape because my meeting was over, the next speaker started speaking. And this person was talking about optoelectronic integrated circuit using a technique called MOCVD. This is an alternate to MBE-based technique. And they were talking about, so the speaker started saying that how difficult it has been for AT&T to create these integrated circuits. I mean, they had been, they said that they had been doing this for 15 years. Huge amount of data are available, and they were showing all this complex gas flow in the MOCVD reactor. And they were sort of all there, physicists, chemists, manufacturing people, all of them sitting together in that room. And then they were complaining that to design one mask for this integrated test circuits takes more than a year. And even then, they cannot really tell whether this design has been good or not. They have to do a lot of experiments to figure it out. It is a hugely intensive, labor-intensive process. So I finished the meeting, and I have never heard even about the word MOCVD before. But halfway down the corridor, all of a sudden, I realized that what they were talking about is actually minority carrier electron diffusion in a diode, in a three-dimensional diode. And this MOCVD problem are mathematically and they are essentially physically, they are the same problem. They are not looking at the problem in the way that it can be looked at. Because I was doing lasers, so I knew diode modeling and all, but this is, so I just came to my office, closed the door, and whatever notes I took, I then reformulated. I made a process simulator from a device simulator, quote unquote, MOCVD process simulator. It took me just hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. And as soon as I saw the first results, I knew that this problem will be solved. And that night before I went home, I sent an email to the person who was showing me the data and that can you send me the data so that I can see whether the theory is reasonable or not. That person was very kind. In the next morning, showed me a bunch of data. And in the afternoon, I called the meeting of the same group of people that I have heard before. They have never heard about me because, you know, I'm just a young person working in a different division. And I explained that how these two problems are exactly the same and how they should do the mass design, regardless of how complex the mass design is. In 15 minutes, they should be able to design all this mass. So next year, there were probably $300 million of this optoelectronic integrated circuit that were sold and each one of them contained my design. So, you know, in some way, because they had so much careful data, all the people have taken the data, that was sort of really helpful. Without it, we'd not be able to make any progress. But at the same time, this analogy and this accidental connection, that is what I have come to love over the years. And is because often, although a problem may be very difficult when in one domain, but a neighboring domain can shine light on it in an unexpected way that can help one to make progress. So of course, many people helped in this effort eventually, but that was the first time from the fundamental, I went to a little bit more practical in addressing engineering problems.
Well, it's a fantastic story. I think, like, you know, this reminds me of Thomas Koidat of Stanford. So he was sharing his story about, like, you know, how the rapid thermal annealing came to reality. And yeah, it's right, like, you know, the finding out the physics within that maze, it's reminding me also of Ramanujan. Ramanujan, he didn't have any professional training or degrees, but it was told that he could find out the pattern even in the night sky, right? Within the stars. And true. And he could actually mathematically describe them. That's the genius, like, you know, that he had. And you just reminded us about those kind of stories. So thanks for sharing that. Because you know that this question, when we set, then we thought that it's going to be a straightforward answer. But eventually, I realized that it is not. Many actually do not even believe. Some actually believe. And some could identify that what was their eureka moment. So the question that I have for you is now that, you know, you worked on many different things, but can you, like, you know, did you feel that kind of eureka moment? And if so, would you like to actually shed some of your own insights on that?
I think the story I just told you was my eureka moment, because in some way I realized that although my math may not be perfect, my coding may not be the most sophisticated, there are many people better than me in these type of things. They're physics, they're better physicists and chemists, engineers than me. But I had this gift of analogy and being a little bit fearless, can analogy and geometry, these two connective things, I discovered that this is something I can really help with. So in that sense, that was my eureka moment in terms of eureka. By that, in some ways, the self-discovery, that what is your place in this big place of big scheme of things, and what is your strength? I think that probably was helpful. But one thing that was really opened up this work, that it immediately, it was in the news in the department, I started getting a lot of recognition. But more important, what had happened, it opened a floodgate of people coming to my office, problem with interesting unresolved problems. And that was very helpful, because, you know, somehow they had this perception that although this person may not know much, he's willing to listen and maybe he will come up with something interesting. And so that is how I actually got into the reliability physics of semiconductor devices. I've spent last 20 years thinking about the physics of reliability. Because if you think about it, that by testing for just a couple of hours, you are projecting for a lifetime of 10 T, and in case of solar cells, 40 years. By testing few hundred devices, you are betting your company that will be producing maybe 10 to the power 15, 10 to the power 16 number of transistors. You're betting your company that these would be reliable. And this type of extrapolation involves the deepest physics in terms of scaling theory, reaction diffusion models, and percolation models. You borrow ideas from physics, chemistry, biology to make this type of reliability physics happen. So again, it came out as an accidental thing. There was one person, she's a colleague, Bonnie Weir, she stopped by saying that, "I hear that you had been working on different things. So we have a problem. People are saying that gate oxide below 3 nanometer cannot be reliable, and therefore scaling has to stop. And therefore, but I am seeing some strange results that even after the first breakdown, the transistor is not dying. And but I don't understand that, why sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So, but on that problem, then gradually more time I spend, I gradually realize that this notion of soft and hard breakdown, the theory of percolation, how thin oxides are fundamentally different from thick oxides. So you asked about Eureka moment. I think the first one led to opening of a lot of door, and they gave me a lot of benefit of doubt that even when I was wrong, they were able to do additional experiments because they thought that it might be helpful. So that's how it started in terms of the reliability physics. I've been doing that for almost last 20 years now. Very, very enjoyable and very deeply satisfying in being able to create something, a new field, that connects all the dots in an unexpected ways.
So, you know, that from laser to MOCVD to reliability physics, you have a large portfolio of things that you have worked on. Is there any particular one that, you know, that really makes you happy that, yes, this is something that I did or I have done, which gives still today, which brings a smile to your face, and any associated memory with that?
I think the reliability work is something that underlies everything I have done since at Bell Labs later on and since then. The reliability study, the gate dielectric breakdown work, that was deeply satisfying intellectually. And the negative bias temperature instability, another degradation mechanism that will be with us forever, so long CMOS exists, NBTI will probably exist. And all this, again, was solved with an economy that probably was unexpected. Economy meaning economy of concepts and economy of the approach. So I think I'm very sort of satisfied, deeply satisfied with those two work. And of course, these days we work on biosensors, and we were one of the first one to use the sort of the quote unquote blood culture of bacteria to see whether they are dead or alive. So this type of newer work is also very satisfying. But in terms of enduring work, I think the reliability physics is something that will probably stay for here for some time to come.
Okay, now it's an interesting question. And that is that, you know, you have looked around many different things. Some of the things that you did not explore, but maybe they caught your eye. So let's say that if you are given the chance to start over, do you have chosen what you are doing right now, or you have chosen something different?
Oh, I think, this is a hard question, as you know. I think I would have still chosen a very similar life. In terms of the philosophical angle of it, this lifelong opportunity to ask questions, to go and being able to teach, and then sort of read very broadly. This is something structurally, I mean, this is something I would have liked anyway. This is something in some ways ideal. Whether these topics are the ideal or not, that I cannot say, because I have a slightly different philosophy about this, that I have often said that, you know, the problems have to be timely, but the solution has to be timeless. And by that, I simply mean that, yes, when I was working on MOCVD crystal growth, then that was a timely problem. And you can only work with timely problems, the problem that are at hand. But the way the questions were answered, whether it's NBTI, or whether it's a TDDP, whether it's a optoelectronic integrated circuit, it was answered with a depth and generality that even if the original problem goes away, this will still be can be used as an analogy or as a template for other problems to come. So in that sense, although I have just worked on a few things, I hope the work will have a life in topics that were not yet touched or that I didn't have an opportunity to work on. Does it sort of make sense?
Yeah, of course, that makes sense. Okay, so now is the part that we are switching, which is very popular with our younger audience, and we call it the rapid fire round. We expect that you would be responding within a word or two, but you have, you know, you can elaborate definitely. Whenever you are ready, I'll go ahead and we'll start those questions.
Okay.
What are your hobbies?
Primarily reading.
Music or movie? Which one you enjoy more?
Both. But for movies, I like all these animated cartoons like Up or Inside Out, WALL-E. I find them. They speak about human condition better than the actual movies. I like these cartoons very much, cartoon or animated movies.
Okay, so you also responded to the genre of the movie that you like. What is the book you're reading now?
This is a good pastime for me. So the book I'm reading now is this Anarchy by William Dalrymple. This is about history of East India Company and how such a simple company with just a few investors in 1599 eventually ruled almost a continent in the subcontinent. And I'm, as I said, originally that I'm from Bangladesh, and my understanding about the history of the subcontinent completely changed after reading this book. So this is what I am reading. And, there are in the last month, I have also read Code Breakers by Isaacson. This is about this CRISPR technology. So there are lots of very interesting books coming out. So these are the sort of history, technology. These are the things, books I like.
Okay. What is your favorite cuisine?
So it has to be Indian fusion food and maybe West African food.
Okay. Any sports you enjoy?
I was very good at table tennis, and I think I can still play pretty well, but not in the competitive level anymore.
Okay. What is your favorite travel spot?
I don't have any travel spot per se, but I like being on the plane, because in some way that is the spot that is in some way most enjoyable when the, you know, in the morning sun coming up the city is coming in view when the plane is landing, or you are seeing on the other side of the clouds. It makes you think both in grateful and in some way in awe that what we little humans are capable of. I mean, flying is seeing the other side of the clouds. Not even the birds have seen this. And in some way, we can do this routinely. This never fails to amaze me. Every time I fly, I cannot believe that this is possible.
Very interesting. So we are at the last part of our conversation, and this is going to focus on the future. And my first question regarding that is, what is your thought about electronics in the future?
I think we have focused over the last 50 years primarily on computing and communication, because communication even 20 years ago was very different from the communication that we have now. Computing has enabled communication in a fundamental way. But I feel that sensors would be one of the things that is neglected and has an enormous opportunity for informing this. I think many times our computing is so energy intensive and the computers need to work so hard because the sensors are providing imperfect information, that we are not processing the data at the edges. And therefore, once there is imperfect data, of course, then we are trying very hard to extract information from the imperfect data. So I envision that one day there, this world would be, this globe would be covered by sensors providing dynamic, up to the moment information, and that will allow actionable things to sort of for variety of engineering and societal challenges that we face.
Okay. The next question, this is broad, and you can choose from whatever you feel. Is there anything that strikes your mind which can be better today?
Yeah, I think this is an important, very important question. I think there is a lot of things can be better today. Our manufacturing is too energy intensive and it is environmentally unsound. Our computing wastes a lot of energy. The Industrial Revolution has provided has lifted humanity in terms of from the poverty or from starvation, but at enormous cost. And technology has been responsible for part of the damage done. And it has also, the society has gotten very rapidly fragmented by the use of technology. Today, it's better, easier to talk to a person on the other side of the globe than being able to turn the phone off and then talk to the person sitting next to us. So I think this exclusive focus on technology at the absence of humanity's education is doing a disservice. We are producing engineers who are very narrowly focused in achieving groundbreaking things, but without simultaneously realizing that or thinking more deeply about what the technology might imply for society in general. So I think our technology needs to be more deeply ingrained in social sciences and our understanding of humanity. And this is something I'm increasingly seeing fragmentation in the industry, of course, and also in academia, where English departments, history departments are gradually disappearing and have no opportunity to train future engineers in a more thoughtful evolution of the technology that they would develop.
So I think this is the first time I'm going to do this with this question, because you love analogy so much. So let's take an example of a knife. So when you give the knife to an accomplished chef, he or she does amazing stuff, right? Prepares amazing food. But the same knife, if it goes to the wrong person, can actually cause a lot of atrocities. So technology, in a sense, that it is, you know, it is lifeless. And the way that we are utilizing them, right? Like, you know, it's the question, correct? So how do you find it, right? Like, you know, that is the more technology but irresponsible usage, or less technology and less irresponsible usage.
No, you asked the right question, that that technology itself doesn't have any life. But technology, as just as in a knife, it's a part of a broader system, ecosystem. Would you allow the knife to be, a sharp knife to be carried by a very young child or not? Or would you put it in some sort of restrict the use? These are policy decisions. These are social decisions, social agreement. Only thing I'm saying that just creating technology in vacuum without thinking about this consideration may lead us, fragmentation in the society that may be very harmful. So I don't say less technology per se, but more judicious use of the technology. I do like when I can call up my mother across the ocean, photons going under the ocean, bouncing over the in the satellites up and down, and her face shows up on my screen. But it would be sad. So that part I like, but it would be sad if I, while I'm checking all these emails and everything, thinking about people other side of the globe, but not thinking about the suffering of my neighbor. So I think there has to be a balance between the judicious use of technology and at least a broader discussion among engineers that is there something that can be done?
Okay. So maybe it's connected, maybe not, but what application would you like to see in the future that does not exist today?
So one thing I often have dreamt about is this a worldwide grid. I am worried that this storage technology people often talk about in terms of lithium battery or various battery-based technology, this is going to be the next quote-unquote oil. The reason is that these are found in specialized mines and different places. And I can easily see that sooner or later, because of the geopolitical considerations, there would be strife to control these resources. If we had a worldwide grid, sun is always shining somewhere and the energy is always being used somewhere else. And if the electric lines would power the, you know, the network under the roads in smart transportation, then the cars can charge as they are running over the road without having to have a big storage that will. So this is, in some way, I feel that a broad globe scale solutions to this problem are necessary, because otherwise it is going to be the same story all over again. With the lithium battery and all, yes, it's much more efficient, but people will also be driving more. And then this extracting these minerals, which are not earth abundant, will again cause probably a lot of deep social international challenges. So I have this dream of that someday, maybe there'll be world would be able to share the grid, and then they'll be able to share this energy resources, and that way both the environment and the other aspects of the society would benefit significantly from them. So that's one thing I could immediately think of.
Okay. Well, one of the things, like, you know, that because you, so I am kind of like, you know, playing a little bit devil's advocate. So one of the things is that eventually you are resorting to a technology, right, the grid. But at the same time, if you look at currently what's going on today in the world, that in some geographic locations, mad people can take them over and can actually bring the whole system into a halt. So eventually that when we say, oh, this is a Machiavellian, the things going on, or like, you know, that those were the barbaric ages, but these are being kind of repetitious. It's sort of like, you know, we face the similar kind of challenges because of some people's absolute greed, lunacy, narcissism, and for, it's like, it's not my interview, but this is like, you know, I take these opportunities to share. So what I say is, maybe as human, which makes us unique among all the living species, is we can think. And maybe we have stopped thinking. Because if we really start thinking, then I think, like, you know, that will give us a lot of introspection, and we will start behaving like human being rather than like, you know, the other things are going to just, like, you know, follow us, because it's the things that we create in a sense. But the humanity is really depends on the deep thinking. But anyway, I think, like, you know, the going, it is the last formal question from the script that we have. And that is that if you would like to, you know, that what is your advice? Let's say one piece of suggestions for the young generation.
Yeah, I think one thing I would say is that creativity comes in all shapes and sizes. This is something I did not understand when I was younger. I thought that you have to be very good at math or very good at experiment or very good at some aspect or another in order to be creative. Creativity really is inbuilt in everybody, because everybody is unique. And they or see the world, or they when they read a book, or when they analyze a problem, everybody brings their own angle to it. So by definition, everybody's approach is in some way unique. Finding confidence in that approach, and that one can be creative, only thing that is requires is that hard work and patience, and maybe passion. So this is one, the only thing I would do, that if somebody, we often think that one has to be creative in a specific way, but what I have found that people can be creative and can do remarkable contributions just by being themselves and taking solving a problem or trying to solve the problem in their own way. I think this is everybody can do, and young people in particular, they have an opportunity to do this or practice this a little bit more than we old people are.
You know, that your answer takes us back to the first question, like, you know, that we were discussing, that having the right mentor, right? Like, you know, if Cristiano Ronaldo, we were asked him to actually, like, you know, do math, maybe you would not have been that much like successful. But you know, early discovery of everyone's inner, I would say, the passion as well as, like, you know, the strength, and a good mentor can definitely help. In your case, you know, that you have been benefited, and you have personally contributed to many, many people's life from that perspective, including mine, just to let you know. So, okay. Thank you so much for for your kind participation. And this is a question from my side, and I'm asking this to everyone, that was there anything that I should have asked, but I didn't? If you would like to, like, you know, the talk about anything that maybe we didn't give you the opportunity.
No, I think the broad questions you asked about the formative experience, the ability to find oneself in quote unquote Eureka moments, and what we think about the future. I think this is exactly exactly the right question to ask. One point I would make, maybe just as a general thing, is this. People often think about teaching and research to be independent, that this is especially prevalent in big research universities, that sometimes one thinks about teaching and research to be different. But I often find that teaching is actually deeply supportive of research, because when you go and explain something to a student, the students may or may not learn much, but you definitely are learning something. Because when I came to Purdue from Bell Labs, I knew certain things deeply. But the students, every class I walked into, they poked hole in my understanding, or the word discovered holes in my understanding. And by being gradually being humble and gradually patching those things up, have allowed me to move in different topics with considerable ease and have deepened my understanding about what it means to be a researcher. So I think one thing, if I had any opportunity to say, is to say to my colleagues or the future engineers that either classroom teaching or informal setting or this lunchroom meeting where you talk to people and describe your ideas is where actually the most benefit can come from. Creativity can arise from that intersection. So this is one thing I'd like to add in response to your question.
Thank you for attending this IEEE EDS-sponsored podcast. To listen to other EDS podcasts, as well as benefits and resources EDS offers, please go to the website eds.ieee.org. Thank you for listening.